We have everybody here, and I welcome you all here. I was asked to give a talk, something about that I taught in the drug design class. And I had kind of a dilemma here. I could have picked a method that was more like a computational, but because we have a good number of experimental papers who would be bothered by another highly technical talk of what people do in the computational side, I instead chose to pick a more general thing that should be of good interest for both experimental and computational biochemists. And why is it so? Well, because on the experimental side, when we carry out research, one of the first questions that we often ask is what protein is worthwhile studying. And very much the same question pops up in pharmaceutical industry also. When we're trying to target a specific disease, the first thing we want to ask, or one of the first things we want to ask, is what protein should we focus on in order to attack the pathogen or in order to correct the error in our metabolism. And so the aspect that my talk will be focusing today on in pharmaceutical industry is known as target validation. That is verifying or validating that particular macromolecule, particular protein, is indeed relevant to the progress of that disease, and somehow altering the function of that macromolecule will affect the outcome of the disease. And it turns out that not all targets are created equal. Let's say if you think about HIV, it is not quite a coincidence that there is a good number of drugs available now for HIV reverse transcriptase or for HIV protease, as opposed to, for example, HIV integrase, which also seems to be an important protein in the life cycle of HIV virus and its infection. However, clearly, some proteins were more easy to validate as far as their importance goes. And as of today, people haven't shown effectively that interfering with HIV integration in the late stage of infection is going to really do anything good. So first of all, what is the target? And I already alluded, target is a macromolecule or some sort of molecular complex that is critical for the disease. An example here could be some enzyme that is required to carry out certain metabolic pathway. The illustration below is about bacterial cell wall synthesis. And it is a complex metabolic pathway with several enzymes participating. And the goal for pharmaceutical chemists or pharmaceutical biochemists here is to recognize which of these enzymes would be worthwhile targets and which enzymes would be better left alone. And people have identified two enzymes that seem to be unique enough in their function and properties to that particular bacterial pathway and are not then found in similar roles in human metabolism. Those are transglycosylase and transpeptidase. Transglycosylase is an enzyme that makes specific covalent bonds between two sugar moieties of N-acetyl galactosamide and N-acetylmuramic acid. And transpeptidase is an enzyme that makes specific peptide bonds between or cross-links two sugar moieties to create the three-dimensional mesh-shaped structure of the cell wall. And it implies or employs the amino acids as the substrates. So some examples of common drug targets that people have looked at and their roles of action, certainly people have looked at large number of enzymes, and we can target enzymes by designing reversible or irreversible inhibitors that will knock out the function of the enzyme, thus letting or thus preventing the formation of reaction products. That is the most obvious one. It turns out that enzymes are not the most widespread targets as far as the current research or drugs on the market go. It turns out that receptors are far more important targets in terms of the gross dollar amount of money brought in by pharmaceutical industry. And here we are trying to design the molecules that are agonists that would function similarly to the natural substrate or antagonist molecules that would oppose the effect of natural ligand on the cell surface receptor. Also, viral surface proteins is a good emerging target, and very recently there has been successful targeting of HIV code proteins interfering with the HIV cell fusion, which I will talk in a moment. The goal obviously here is to make sure that the virus will lose its ability to enter the cell or inject its genetic material into the cell. Ion channels are typically in mammalian nervous system cells, but also in other type of cells, there are ion channels that regulate the influx of positive and negatively charged ions. Sometimes they are gated, meaning that they are controlled by other ligands, sometimes they are not gated. And here we try to come up with compounds that will selectively block or open those channels, thus altering altering the ion balance across cell membrane. Transporters could be either transporters can be molecules that allow bacteria or harmful pathogens to take in nutrients from the environment, for example, lactose permease is a well-studied example. Or more importantly, they can be molecules, macromolecules, that transport molecules out from the cell. And those fall into the category of multi-resistant drug proteins that will recognize drug molecules as something that the infectious part of the bacterium does not like in it, and will kick those things out. And so they have bacterial multi-drug transporters that will export the drugs that have entered the bacterium. Or you have mammalian equivalents that are one of the main causes why cancer drugs, or why the resistance to cancer drugs develops. Cancer cells acquire ability to actively transport drug molecules out from cancer cells. And so if we can somehow inhibit that kind of import or export, or if necessary, such in case of some nervous system, central nervous system diseases, enhance the import or export of molecules into the cells, that can alter the cause of pathogenesis. Obviously, as everybody knows from our lab, DNA or ribonucleic acids are valuable drug targets. But it doesn't only go about the binders, they also can have alkylating agents. There is a good amount of active research going on. We try to come up with sequence selective alkylating agents. And then you can also try to come up with molecules that are wrong substrates, such as ACT, that will get incorporated into the extending or growing chain of DNA from RNA, HIV RNA, but then will function as a chain terminator. As I already alluded, in the general market, the enzymes and the receptors make up the lion's share of targets. The abbreviation GPCRS or GPCR is G protein coupled receptors. Sorry, on that line actually, enzymes make up the lion's share and G protein receptors are, unless I put two things in stuff, I'm sorry. And ion channels being the next one, everything else, notice how little DNA is currently being used as drug targets, despite a couple of decades of good effort in antisense drug development. So one example I'm trying to show.
Which one was the most?
The enzyme of the group is the most common one with 47%, and G protein coupled receptors is the second one. The problem with, or one of the reasons why enzymes are better targets to study than G protein coupled receptors to some extent, is that for enzymes, we have far more structural information. It is relatively straightforward task nowadays to purify and crystallize an enzyme, while for the G protein coupled receptors, we still lack an adequate mammalian model for a good G protein coupled receptor. For years, people thought that adoption receptor from bacterium was a decent model. Quite recently, the bovine adoption from mammalian system was crystallized and partial structure was solved. And what they learned from that structure was that the bacterial model was completely useless as far as the mammalian receptors go, but they still do not have clear structural understanding about how those receptors are built. There are some ion channels have been studied to structural detail, the nicotinic, or the, some of the gated ion channels are pretty well studied. That is correct, yes. You do not have to worry about getting the drug into the cell necessarily. And some of the methods, it turns out that even though it comes to the structural biochemistry, some of the methods to find out or screen for receptor binders could be faster than finding enzyme inhibitors. Because you can do direct binding assays on crude cell membranes, you do not have to go and do the Michaelis-Menten kinetics and determine inhibition constants. So you have a little bit of speed advantage sometimes there. And here I'm walking through one of the examples. This is a recently employed target. Its validation is now decade plus something old. It is the HIV surface, one of the HIV surface proteins. And overall, that is kind of the current advanced view of how an HIV particle might look, partially based on experimental structure and partially on artist rendering. And the main players of that structure are various lipid bilayer, or you have lipid bilayer around that, and then you have protein. The main spiral-filled proteins are the GP120, it's a glycoprotein that has highly variable or highly variable genetic code and quite variable glycosylation pattern. And then inside or under that GP120 is protein known as GP41, which is actually the arrow that punches coal into the cell, literally speaking. It is the GP41 that carries out the fusion process, while GP120 has cleverly evolved during the viral evolution to hide the business end of GP41, and by the fact that it is such a variable protein with a variable glycosylation pattern, makes the surface of the protein pretty much invisible for our antibodies. Our antibodies look at that and say, well, it doesn't look anything very constant, it looks like a bunch of lipid or a bunch of sugar molecules and some protein, and they do not know very well what to do. So originally, of course, people were trying to focus on GP120 as an obvious target because it is a surface protein, but they quickly figured out that the genetic variability of that makes GP120 a really poor target. You can't design a specific drug because the molecule just changes so rapidly. So let's look a little bit on how the integration process occurs, what happens when the viral particle and the cell meet. So here we have our cell, here is our viral particle, here is the GP41 that is now covered with GP120, so the white half moons are GP120s. And at that point, we have several specific interactions. On the T cell surface, we have CD4 plus receptors that will interact with GP120. And that is just kind of the very initial event of the fusion. But that will signal essentially the approach of the HIV virus to the T cell. And then the core of CP41 will make direct contact with the target T cell. There is some sort of conformational change that occurs in a rather short time span. People are not quite sure at what point or for how long the CP41 organizes into a three helix bundle. But that is the active form of that molecule. And so here is our three helix bundle, or before it is formed into helices, we have the three helices of CP41, or three polypeptides of CP41 that are surrounded by highly variable CP120 before the fusion. And then in the fusion process, those relatively unorganized chains will undergo conformational change forming a helical bundle. The X-ray structure of that helical bundle has been determined and is shown on that slide before. And one thing that you notice in that process is that the part that now is interacting with the cell membrane in that conformational change process, or essentially this part here, will fold over mechanically and make contact with this part here, and this part here will aggregate, and in that process the cell membrane is being brought along. So essentially this part here and this part here will move together in the fusion process, and we will fuse the cell membrane from T cell from bacterial membrane. So that was the essence of the fusion process. And obviously the GP41, its specificity to form such a self-aggregation is critical for that. So idea, of course, is that if we somehow can interfere with that sort of self-aggregation, if we can prevent the interaction of those blue domains with that green domain and formation of that helical bundle system between the N-terminal and C-terminal parts, then the HIV virus will not fuse with the cell. It will just get stuck on the cell surface, but it is unable to insert the genetic material into the T cell. So that is just a slide that shows that what are potential experiments that people have done to validate, to really show that it is GP41 and not something else that is critical for that. And the important part is shown here, so you can read that, but they say that we find that the GP41 cytoplasmic tail is necessary for efficient establishment of a productive spreading infection in the majority of T cell lines tested peripheral for mononuclear cells and monocyte-derived macrophages. So those are the main cell types that are affected by HIV, and they show that if they make a mutant where they cut off the cytoplasmic tail of that GP41, then you are virus particles that are non-infectious. They can not infect cells. and that was done in 1997, which is pretty much the essence of the validation. We carry out or do some sort of modification of the protein. We still have a normal looking viral particle, but that viral particle is now unable to carry out the function. So after that, or before that, people suspected that GP41 was somehow important, but after that study came out, it was clear that interfering somehow with that cytoplasmic tail of GP41 would be a wise way to target HIV. Kind of backing out now from that specific example, in that case people were successful in pretty early time to validate that protein as a target. However, people still feel the target validation is one of the most pressing problems in current pharmaceutical research and development, and people believe that without many or new well-validated targets, the companies are not able to maintain current profitability. The pipeline will dry up, and people will be working on things that have questionable value as targets. And that obviously means that if you work a lot on something that is not turning out to be a working target at the end, you might have done lots of interesting biochemistry, but as far as curing the disease, you're not getting too far. So what are the criteria for a validated target? The most important one is that regardless of what the biochemical theory says about that protein, we really need to show that that particular protein is pathophysiologically relevant. So it somehow must be involved in that particular metabolic pathway or in that particular synthetic route that that cells use. Typically that step that we are taking is that we are determining the determining the sequence of suspected targets either through DNA sequencing or through direct protein sequencing. And then we will carry out classical biochemical studies or molecular biology type knockout experiments where we try to elucidate the function and mechanism of that particular protein. And then we will go back to animal models where we have now created somehow altered form of that protein, or we have created an animal where that protein has been knocked out or somehow suppressed, and will show or prove in animal models that altering the function of that target or the level of concentration of that target will have real effects on the outcome of the disease. Well, when people were working on human genome, everybody was very, very excited that after we figure out all the letters in our genome, we will have tons of targets to work. But actually, after people figured out that we have only about 20,000 genes in our genome, and they started doing a little bit more deep thinking, their view has turned into a much more pessimistic one. Currently, we know about 500 well-established targets. Does it mean that out of the 30,000 human genes that are unique functional genes, we have still 29,000 left? Probably not. The reason is that we have out of the human genome maybe only about 10% of genes that have something to do with diseases that are either inherited diseases or confer some susceptibility for particular bacterial or viral infections. So people think that maybe there is only about 3,000 genes that have anything to do with infections or any sort of disease. And then on the other hand, another 10% of our genome would be in the state that it is made of molecules that you can design ligands for, that you can effectively bind something specifically. The rest of that are molecules that do not have appropriate surface features for specific binding, or are molecules that lack the selectivity in their binding. So the intersection of those two things is not quite well understood what how large an intersection should be, but estimates about how many disease-modifying genes are druggable at the same time range somewhere around 1,000. So low pessimists say that, well, maybe there is only 600 and we have only about 100 left, and the optimists say that, well, there might be another 1,000 to discover in the future. Well, keeping the optimist line, and I say that there probably is good amount of work, people have invested good amounts of money into validating or figuring out what those potential 1,000 targets left are, because each of the successful targets can be patented, and if you can develop a drug for that one, well, that's obviously business wise a good thing. And I can break the technology talk here into two parts, and the dividing line between the old and new era is that the approach or the availability of genomic methods So in the pre-genomic science, that refers to the efforts where classical biochemistry and classical molecular biology and classical genetics techniques were broadly used. And of course, their main goal was to identify function of a given protein. So they took kind of a singular approach. They said, I suspect that this is a target. And then they put effort into figuring out what that particular protein does. What does it interact with, and where in the cell that protein occurs, where in the cell does it function. And the classical methods that were used in the past and are still used, it is not that those methods have faded away, but they haven't supplemented with new sets of more efficient methods, were traditional modifications of that gene. Either you make a point mutations in critical residues, or you will truncate that so that it doesn't localize in the correct place, let's say you cut off the nuclear localization signal, or in some other way alter the gene. In the most extreme case, you can just knock the gene out from the organism and study how the knockout functions. There are a couple of techniques borrowed from molecular biology, phage display, HIF-2 hybrid system, and expression cloning that help to understand some of those questions. For example, using the phage display or HIF-2 hybrid system, you can find out what that particular protein interacts with, while expression cloning is a powerful way to determine where in the cell the protein is expressed. And I will take a moment and give a very brief overview about those techniques. They are complex techniques, and please do not be very worried if there are aspects that remain confusing, but at the same time, please go ahead and ask if you want some verification how one or another method works. Now, coming down to simple gene alteration ones, example here, for example, how a particular enzyme, in this case dihydrofolate reductase, well known for our computational group, of course, Benkovich group, worked extensively on that enzyme. That is actually a dual enzyme in that parasite. It carries out the hydrofolate reduction reaction and also synthesizes thymidylase in the next step, which is a dual enzyme. And it was shown that this enzyme is critical for product or for setup of leishmaniasis, known locally in southern parts of the world as Salar-Azar. It's a parasite infection, about 20 million people infected worldwide. And what happens is that in your blood you have those parasites living that will cause essentially skin deformities. Expensive cures for that are available, but there is nothing that will really be easily affordable for the local populations in tropical India or Africa where it occurs. And so, for example, for them, the experiment to do was to knock out, they genetically modify the parasite by eliminating that particular gene from the parasite genome. They obtained parasites that were able to grow, but they were not able to cause a disease. So now you have reaction that, evidence that that particular reaction is necessary to establish infection. Eliminating the catalyst for that reaction will not allow the infection to progress. So from that point on, we know that if you can somehow target specifically that dihydrofolate reductase from that parasite organism, leaving the human equivalent, if there is one intact, we can probably come up with a cure for that enzyme or for that disease. Okay, phage display is a method that uses bacteriophage. If you recall what that, or if you don't know what bacteriophage is, the simple explanation for that is that it is a virus that infects bacteria in a similar way as we are infected by flu bacteria or flu virus. There are certain virus particles that find bacteria as suitable hosts to propagate their genetic information. And they typically look like the cylinders of protein. They have extremely simple structure. They have a couple of different proteins that make up their surface coat. And then there are unique proteins at the tip of each of those particles. And the tip is encoded obviously by a different gene. Inside that protein, and this is captured, you have a circular DNA molecule of relatively small size, something that already people in the 80s were able to work using the traditional molecular biology genetic manipulation tools.
Is this the lambda phase for DNA?
It's similar to that. I don't think that they use the lambda phage for that particular one. I forgot what the name of that particular one is. And so inside the genome there is a region here that encodes for that tip protein. And what one can do is, of course, take, because the TIP protein is involved in the recognition of bacterial surface, kind of the signal, the binding signal, you can think of that as a ligand for receptors on the cell surface. But if we don't try to use those bacteriophages as to infect the cells, if we just want to do some interesting binding studies with them, we can knock out the original gene and put our favorable or our favorite gene into that place. So let's say if you are studying, let's see, what are we studying here in the lab in recent days? Alcohol dehydrogenase. Let's say if your goal is to figure out what other proteins that alcohol dehydrogenase interacts with, probably not too many, it's an enzyme, but just as a point of example, we could put the gene that encodes for alcohol dehydrogenase here, and then let that phase to propagate through one cycle to make its proteins, and then the phase particles that emerge from bacteria carry the alcohol dehydrogenase protein at a single position at the tip of that phase. And the rest from that point on is just a similar, very similar affinity chromatography. So what we are essentially, the advantage of course of that is that each of those molecules or each of those phases can be propagated through bacteria. So every time that you think that you want to multiply your valuable phage, you can put them back into bacteria, and the bacteria will produce tons of copies of the same identity. And so how one goes about that kind of process, it is called biopanning, or I think biopanning was the name that I was familiar with. Let's say that here is our target molecule. We are suspecting, for example, that alcohol dehydrogenase might be interacting with aldehyde dehydrogenase, next enzyme in the path, so maybe there is some association between two enzymes. You can test that by immobilizing your aldehyde dehydrogenase here on the plate, and then exposing that to the phase that encodes for alcohol dehydrogenase. And if those two proteins indeed interact, you will form here, when you have a binding event, and that phase gets bound to the plate, you will wash out other phages, and then you can take the phage and transfer that after elution to bacteria, and bacteria will amplify that more, and now you have a large number of those phages. So that's a kind of trivial example to do one-to-one search. The power of that really comes in from the fact that you can have a library of things, and library here means that you can have population of phages, and each phage contains different proteins. So let me now pose the question a little bit differently. Let's say that we want to find an unknown protein that would interact with alcohol dehydrogenase. In that case, we will create a library where we take, let's say, all human proteins, proteins, put their genetic code into the bacteriophage, and then each bacteriophage expresses one human protein on the cell surface. If we have 30,000 different bacteriophages in our solution, a couple of microliters in the volume, you will have each human protein represented on the surface of that little virus particle. Then you put your alcohol dehydrogenase here on the plate and dump all the phages on the microtiter plate. Wash away the ones that do not bind. The ones that do bind, you will then elute in the next step and amplify through the bacteria, and then the only thing that you have to do is to cut out that stretch of DNA, read the sequence, and you will automatically know which protein interacted with the alcohol dioxide hydrogenase. So that is a powerful method to figure out protein-protein interactions. Now, of course, alcohol dihydrogenase was an artificial example, but where it comes handy is when you try to unravel signal transduction pathways. Let's say that you have a MAP kinase, and you try to figure out what molecules MAP kinase interacts with, then you could do that meaningfully with MAP kinase. Little bit similar system, but not suffering so much from the restrictions imposed by bacteria. Couple of problems with bacteria is that bacteria do not carry out post-translational modification, so lots of the proteins that are expressed in bacteria lack their appropriate sugar residues, they are not maybe correctly modified, some of the secondary reactions are not carried out. And also the interactions that we are doing are done in the test tube or in the microtiter plate, so they are not under physiological conditions. The advantage of what is known as ES2 hybrid system is that we are carrying out screen for protein-protein interactions, but we are doing that in the living system, and we are using a eukaryote yeast in this case that has better reproduction or better capacity to mimic the human proteins. So again, we will create a living library in yeast cells. And here are two terms that are used in the line of biochemistry. There is a bait and prey, and bait is a known protein that is here our protein of interest, which we have covalently fused through genetic engineering strategies to a DNA binding domain of a transcription factor. So now we have essentially a protein that normally would go and sit near some transcription activation site because it has DNA binding properties, and our protein of interest is near that transcription site as well. If we now try to figure out which and of course we put that behind some sort of reported gene, so let's say some gene that will start making blue color under appropriate conditions. So in the first event we just have our base protein, the known protein, sitting near the promoter region of our reported gene. And in the second stage we will take library of different gene clones, and from that library we will obtain human proteins that have been fused together covalently to the transcription activation domain. And so if that if the prey protein and the base protein and the prey protein interact with each other in under natural conditions, that will bring the transcription activator near the site where it should be, and this will turn on the transcription. So that would be those are the yeast cells that will start making blue color. And then in practice all you have to do is take one yeast cell that contains the bait, take a library of yeast cells that contain the prey, let them have little yeast sex, and as a result you will have diploid genes with two little chromosomes or two elements of that. And in case where this one, where the bait protein and the prey protein interact, that particular yeast turns blue because the reported gene is turned on. So it is really as simple as letting yeast have sex on the agar plate and then picking out blue colonies, extracting the DNA and determining the DNA sequence of that plasmid here. From that you will know which particular protein has the interacting partner. Any questions on that? Alright, if we went through that, I'm trying to be easy on expression cloning. Again, there is lots of little nitty-gritty steps, but the bottom line is that with expression cloning we are fusing our protein of interest into some sort of fluorophoric or fluorescence-giving molecule, and then we will find a way to detect that fluorescence. So we can use, for example, gene fluorescent protein or something else, and then wherever our protein goes it carries along with it the fluorescence molecule. And then we can look at the fluorescence from that fluorescent molecule, and that will reveal the localization of our protein of interest. Okay, so that was all pretty much known traditional biochemistry. Like when I went to graduate school, I had to study all that. Now there is a cool amount of stuff that has been coming up in recent years and has become more and more productive, mainly for the fact that they can allow rapid screening in a large scale. And so there are both genomic methods with the goals being somewhat similar. We're trying to identify the gene protein functions, and we're trying to specifically ask which genes can be disease modifying. We can now try to narrow it down and do that for targeted validation. And strategies here, the main aspect is that we are taking advantage of all the genomic information that became available after human genome was determined and after we started understanding what those proteins do. The hallmark is that we use high throughput screening methods. Instead of doing one protein at a time, we are trying to do all protein at a time, all protein against all other proteins. And the method, because it's high throughput, that would not be doable by single researcher, so there is a strong interest in automating those processes using microfluidics instead of using pipettes. You have some sort of microcapillary where reactions occur, and using good number of bioinformatics tools. And the four methods that have become more predominant in that field is the use of DNA microarrays, looking for single nucleotide polymorphisms, doing proteomics, especially coupled with mass spectrometry-based sequencing, and most recently RNA knockdown or RNA interference. All right, so is all that really so important and valuable? If we measure the value of things, the reports of things in dollar amounts, it turns out that the post-genomic knowledge validation could be pretty important. There is a little book, 128 pages, but the knowledge in that book was deemed to be worth over $2,000 if you buy a single copy for your own private use. If you want to share that book with your colleagues in the university, you fork out $5,000. So apparently those are hot techniques, and there are good amount of technical know-how that I think is not being transparent from my files or from my slides, but you can obtain that by forking out that amount of money. Alright, so DNA microarrays is one of the earliest techniques, and there are actually nowadays two different approaches to accomplish the same or similar goals. And broadly you can talk about one color array that is being manufactured and marketed by Affymetrics, those are the famous Affy chips or gene chips shown on the picture here, or more academic oriented is the Stanford development of two color arrays. And again, it is not really anything else that is a silicon chip on a piece of paper. They look pretty similar from outset, but their technology is slightly different. So in the one color array, the Affymetrics technology, it's pretty much outlined here. What we are doing is that we start out with a total cellular RNA, and total cellular RNA can be extracted because at the end of that RNA, you have poly A tract. So you will get your RNA molecules, and you will carry out the reverse transcription in vitro to make cDNA. So now you have DNA molecules that have exactly the information that is present in the proteins, but do lack all the regulatory elements. They do not have the promoters, they do not have the upstream regulatory things. They just pretty much contain information for the protein. You will take one more step and you will translate that DNA back to RNA, but in that process you put biotinyl groups on that RNA molecule on the certain or over certain intervals, and then you break that down into fragments and immobilize these fragments on the chip. And so in the process where we're trying to find out what interacts with what, you would then now take a solution of, if that is on the next slide or this slide, and then you will carry out the hybridization against the library of molecules that you will be probing for, and the molecules that would interact, but you have first a binding step, and then you will wash away the ones that do not bind to that particular one, and then you can quantify the color intensity because you use that avidin bound fluorescent marker. I will show that in a moment, what the structure of that molecule is. I found it pretty interesting how they do it. It is not your traditional chemical synthesis where you just do solid-based synthesis to attach these things. It is more similar to how microprocessors are made nowadays. It is a photolithography technique. And you have your wafer, that is silicon wafer. Also silicon wafer, you have your hydroxyl groups that are normally protected with something. It is a silane type thing. And then you can use a mask with specific little holes in it, and every place where you have hole on that mask, you will burn off the silane and have free OH group, and on that free OH group then you can add a nucleotide. So you can add them one by one in a sequence, and that way you can positionally encode so that you will know based on these masks what nucleotide sequence you have in each step. How to make the biotinyl messenger RNAs, let's see if I can walk through that slide easily or not. We are opening the ring with sodium iodate oxidation, periodate oxidation, and then biotin hydrazide will come and close the ring up, and then you have essentially a structure-wise unperturbed molecule that occasionally carries biotinyl groups. And the detection process relies on photoerythrin. It is a more signal that comes from red algae. And then you will obviously make the, or take advantage of the stronger interaction between biotin and streptavidin. And here you have your normal synthesized probe, and here you would have your biotinated probe that has bound to the chip. So the chip normally carries non-biotinated, probably it was quite clear earlier. On the chip you have non-biotinylated library of ribonucleic acids, and to that one, from the solution you will bind biotinylated ribonucleic acids, and then you will detect the presence of those bioaccumulated ribonucleic acids. The slight difference, or the difference between that previous method and this one, is that on the previous one we measured the intensity of fluorescence, so the scale went from zero to some number. And when we're looking for matches, it turns out that you might be doing better when you look at opposite colors. So Stanford has developed two-color microarrays that they call genome chips to distinguish from the patented gene chips. So there is a gene chip is the commercial one, genome chip is the academic version. And that is best illustrated by an example. Let's say that we are trying to figure out some protein in cancer cell that is expressed at higher level in tumor tissue than in normal cells. And how would one go about finding out about that protein? Well, first of all, you will take your tumor cells and control cells, harvest their messenger RNA, convert that into cDNA, and then at the cDNA level, you will label the molecules, the ones that tumor cells come get a red fluorescent tag attached to them, the ones that come from healthy tissue get a green fluorescent tag mixed to them, and then you will mix those things together in a microarray slider, and you will look what dominates. So if you have one-to-one ratio of red and green, that particular well will show no light or will be yellow. If you have excess of green, you will have normal cells expressing more of that protein. When the well turns into red, that means that the cancer cells express more. So from that kind of thing, you will get not only, but you will get information compared to the normal or standard reference. And so a couple of applications we can do just genome-wide genotyping, where we take everything that our genome contains and dump that on a particular chip and see what is the expression level or what genes are present in that genome, or we can measure the level of expression, how much the gene is expressed, or we can compare mutants to see if there is a particular truncation or particular site-directed mutant or particular single point mutant present in the genome. And in the drug disease or drug discovery process, the importance of course comes from ability to measure the expression. As on the previous slide I showed, you can determine more some proteins are expressed at higher level. Or we can also look for single look at the differences. Single look at polymorphism shown in a couple of next slides. We essentially refer to the fact that how single amino acids in proteins differ from the normal genetic or normal population background. We can do some of the pharmacogenomics examples here could be, and also toxicogenomics, where the example here would be to look how given drug, let's say that we have come up with a good drug and we give that to the patients, and we are worried about what are the side effects of that drug, and we can see if certain proteins are being expressed abundantly after we give that drug. And if that happens, that could be a warning sign that that drug is doing something else than we want to do. It might cause a liver damage, or it might recruit somehow detoxification mechanisms. So doing the toxicogenomics here, understanding how drugs induce protein expression, is critical in establishing the safety of drugs. And then finally, people can use genome chip technology to find out what bacteria make up the bond of naturally occurring bacteria. Single nuclear polymorphisms, so they are typically single nuclear changes that sometimes can result in amino acid change, and if they do not, you can have redundancy in the genetic code if your amino acids do not change. So those single nuclear polymorphisms do not have any functional result, but if the amino acids do change, and that happens with frequency of about 1 roughly in 1,000 base pairs. So for a 300 amino acid long protein, we might expect that between two individuals, there is a fair chance that you have a difference in the protein sequence. And so far, people have found about 1.8 million different differences among individuals. This is pretty much the stuff that gives us individuality. That is why IFC looks into the difference, because our proteins, the basic metabolic proteins, the proteins that define the color of the hair or the skin, have slight nucleotide differences in the single nucleotide polymorphism level. And besides giving the personal characteristics, they also account for susceptibility for drugs or susceptibility for diseases. So how would one go about finding those things? Well, the long and difficult way, of course, is to do sequence comparisons. I would extract my DNA, he would extract his DNA, and we will compare the total DNA sequences or part of that, and then find out what are the differences. And people actually have gone through trouble and done such sequencing for 24 different individuals. It wasn't a complete genome sequence, it was a sequencing of important regions of the genome. And then other approach is to compare regions from Human Genome Project, because in the early days of Human Genome Project, the DNA came from a variety of different individuals, and so one lab might have got one sequence, other lab might have had another sequence. They both believe that they have correct sequence, but if those two sequences differ, that probably is a result of polymorphism in their DNA source. Now, a more fancy way to detect that, which might be some relevance of the work that we are doing in the synthetic side in this lab, are molecular beacons. What are molecular beacons? Essentially, they are single-stranded oligonucleotides that can adopt some secondary or tertiary structures, such as stem loops. And the idea here is that the loop contains some sort of probe sequence. So here on the loop part, we encode the DNA sequence, or DNT sequence if you wish, that can recognize specific DNA sequence in our genome, or in our messenger RNA extract. The ends of this molecule are special. In the one end, you covalently link a molecule that emits light, and in the other end of that molecule, you specifically attach a molecule that absorbs light. And when the fluorophore and the quencher are physically close to each other, you do not have any fluorescence because of the internal energy quenching. And so the normal state of that kind of molecular beacon is in the stem loop structure. Here is our the sequence that we are interested in, and the pink is darker. Now if the molecular beacon encounters a sequence that it is complementary to, that it can bind, the stem loop will unfold, or essentially that whole structure will break down, and physically in the breaking down process, the fluorophore is being separated from the quencher, and of course the fluorophore then can start emitting light.
Eric Cool's done a lot of research.
Yes. It turns out that those things are extremely sensitive and extremely selective. For example, to the level that you can detect differences in single nucleotides, and you can determine whether human being we have two copies of each gene. We can use that technique, for example, to tell whether both genes carry the normal form, whether both genes are changed, or whether only one of the two alleles of that gene are altered. So in that case, we will have, here is our example of homozygous wild type, everything is normal, and then we are using beacons that are, we are using two color beacons here. We are making a beacon that is sensitive to the wild type DNA sequence carrying a red fluorescent molecule. And then what we are,
so people using that for basically trying to catch dominance and like things you would like to hunt them and things like that?
Yes.
That's correct. So before you marry somebody, you might want to mark them.
I do not know if you can just take your wife to be to the genetic testing for that, but I think that they will probably do one or more serious cases, yes. Right. I'm running a little bit short of time. Let me skip more into...
I'm going to have to go in about
7 minutes. I will be done in 7 minutes. I have about 5 or 6 more slides. So the application of that is we are trying to screen families for exactly what Steve was saying, inherited diseases. And we can also do a large-scale population studies if people submit their DNA samples to national databases. That's a relatively rapid way to screen what is the genetic background of that population. And there are several interesting things that people have found using SNPs. People have identified genes that are conferring high susceptibility for Crohn's disease. Also there is some evidence that Parkinson's disease has genetic origin in chromosome 1. There is a gene that seems to be cropping up among Icelanders as a factor that confers high risk for stroke. And there are a well-identified nuclear receptor that is implied for type 2 diabetes. And so that is the idea, actually, that is the idea where we are focusing on trying to figure out what the genes are. So in that approach, we say, well, we want to find out what is the gene that causes Huntington's disease, and we will compare the genomes of Huntington's patients to general population. And then here is what Steve was asking earlier, where we want to find out whether a particular individual carries a disease gene or not. And then,
available
on the internet? As I said, I do not know on the individual level, but I believe that through your doctors, you could do that. And if you, I believe that if you have like a suspicion of a genetically inherited disease that you need, to need to confirm, the technology is there to do it.
Yeah, maybe if the antibody is not expressed on this particular person, so that it's possible that it's inherited from the next
person. Correct, but you do not, like you can work off from either RNA or from DNA. So if it is expressed in you, you can use messenger RNA and do the cDNA work back. But if you're just suspecting that it is, it is not expressed, then what you have to do is get the DNA, do PCR of that DNA to amplify it, and then check the amplification product. So you can work from both ways. And there is a database that lists something about currently identified SNPs and their relevance to disease states. Okay, little punch here for people who like proteins more than biochemistry. And they are pretty much saying that genes are easier now when we try to analyze the proteins, things get much more complicated. And there is a completely different set of techniques that we use to ask or answer similar questions using proteins. An example here would be how can I identify a protein that is responsible or at least is abnormally expressed in people with skin cancer. So again, you will take a sample of the cancerous tissue, sample of the normal tissue, and those tissue samples contain large number of proteins. In any human tissue, you probably have over 1,000 proteins that you can detect using biochemical detection methods. You have to separate them in two dimensions, typically according to their isoelectric point and the molecular weight in SDS page. And then you will compare how those two SDS pages look. And you will probably notice here that on the person that has skin, there is a protein that is absent in the normal person. The next step, of course, is that what the protein is, at that point we only know its isoelectric point and molecular weight. That is not really enough to identify the protein. But one can extract all proteins from those polyacrylamide gels, digest them into small peptides and sequence peptides using mass spectrometry, which is pretty routine technology nowadays. From that you will get the information about the sequence. You will clone the protein into bacteria or express, purify, crystallize, figure out the structure, do all the normal biochemistry. So those are the workforces of proteomics methods. As I mentioned, the 2D electrophoresis and mass spectrometry are the early stage tools. But then all sorts of protein structure methods being the second one. The cartoon here kind of illustrates the dichotomy between the classical biochemistry, the department of biochemistry and molecular biology, consists of people who are trying to fish out the function of a single protein, while the genomics and proteomics people go in and try to fish out everything that they can fish out in a single swoop. Okay. There is a set of techniques in the functional genomics here, and you are familiar with antisense and antisense, oligonucleotides and ribozymes, and maybe not so much about the RNA interference. Antisense, of course, works by interacting with messenger RNA molecules, and I probably do not have to say much here to this audience. Ribosomes can also be used to figure out something about the function of the protein. And the interesting thing that has been taking off more recently is that you can synthetically prepare ribosomes and then you can introduce those ribosomes to cells. The technique that I want to finish my talk with is RNA interference, or RNAi for short. It is a relatively recently discovered phenomenon in 1998. So when I went to graduate school, I did not hear anything about that. I just learned about a couple of years ago about that. And you can think about RNA interference as an extra layer of the immune system for many organisms. It is an immune system that turns on when it encounters foreign RNA molecules and specifically goes and degrades those RNA molecules. its use for the drug discovery is that it helps us to understand something about the gene function, because through RNAi we can degrade specific RNA molecules, thus preventing their expression. It has potential therapeutic value. We could potentially treat people with RNAi agents that will then alter the level of protein expression in body. But at that point, it is highly questionable if the therapeutic value will materialize. And there is some, so far, that seems to be all conferred within one cell. So if we have one cell that gets infected by foreign RNA, that cell mounts an anti-RNA response. In plants, surprisingly, there is some evidence that it is a systemic response, meaning that if you take a leaf of the plant and introduce your foreign RNA to that particular leaf, the whole plant, the rest of the plant, will know that there is such attack coming and is ready to destroy such RNA, not only on that leaf, but in all other parts of the plant also. If that would be the case for mammals or humans, that would open up a lot about the therapeutic uses. But right now, one of the problems with human therapeutics is that in order to use RNAi as a therapeutic, we have to get the therapeutic into each cell. We can't just treat certain cells and expect
something. If you have an RNA that would destroy foreign RNA?
Very good question.
Considering that the native RNAs would have every conceivable structure that you can imagine.
Yes. I will give partial answer to that question to the extent that it is known. The exact molecular details of that process are not very well understood yet. The three-dimensional structure of the players are not known, so we don't know the mechanistic aspect, but we understand who the players are in the process. And the process we can start thinking of with the help of that diagram here. This is our foreign messenger RNA. So it is typically a double-stranded RNA that causes such interference. And when we have double-stranded RNA entering the cell, there is a specific enzyme called dicer that takes that RNA and chops that into smaller chunks. They are still oligonucleotides, they are not anything tiny. But here you have your small oligonucleotides. And those small
protein on a surface or something?
No, those are all cytoplasmic proteins, to my understanding. So here you have to wait until the...
Why don't they cut up native?
Because the native RNA is not double-stranded.
It's not what?
It's not double-stranded.
Oh.
The virus typically uses double-stranded RNA if it is RNA virus.
The messenger RNA, of course, is...
Exactly. Messenger RNA is single-stranded. So it responds to specific types of RNA, such as double-stranded, or we will see in the next slide of some of the loops of hairpins. Okay, and then there is a protein known as RISC that will take up those RNA fragments and use that RNA fragment as a template to bind the RNA that are complementary to the template and cut the complementary RNA. So essentially the idea is here, this is our little template RNA, complementary binding to the target RNA, and target gets degraded. The complementary RNA might get reused. It is not quite.
Does it attack both strands of the
complex? No, it appears. What happens here is that the risk of the double-stranded DNA binding of the double-stranded RNA binding to risk is dissociated. So in that state, we will have single-stranded short oligo bound to risk, and that short oligo then functions as a template. And in the complex here, only the target is being cut, not the template. So it's a single strand cut.
So what's made in this cycle?
That's correct. So it is essentially a catalytic or autocatalytic process. You don't need very much of interfering RNA to cut down all your messenger RNA.
Okay,
so
I'm going to have to go now.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay, I will show you the last slide and then I will come back and explain, but thank you for...
Experience.
All right. Let me go one more time over.
Students must have really loved this course.
I think they did. Thank you. So on the two players that I explained earlier, dicer is an endoribonuclease that cuts the double-stranded RNA into two pieces, and then RISC is a complex that uses that as a cleave, and there are a couple of links if you're interested you can look these up. The products of diester are typically about 21 to 22 long nucleotides. And then there is some sort of unwinding going on as part of the RISC that uses ATP to carry out unwinding. And as Steve earlier pointed out, yes, the fragments are recycled back into RISC. It is not only the double-stranded DNA that can elicit such an interference process, but also some RNA molecules that are loop molecules. They have the double-stranded component here, and then they have loop. And that is something that you can encode within the normal closed genome. So you can insert a gene that will produce the RNA that will form hairpins by itself. And so you can genetically encode into the organism formation of double-stranded DNA molecules. And those hairpin molecules will also function as a substrate for RISC.
Could you induce this in someone for immunity?
Essentially. I mean, it induces immunity against messenger RNA molecules that are complementary to your...
So you can give someone with a vaccine?
Essentially. Essentially. And the problem right now is
that they're generally short-lived. They ultimately are RNA, right? So it wouldn't be lifelong.
Correct. It is just not quite clear how much memory there is in the system, but potentially, right now, people use that as a basic research tool when they're trying to lower the levels of messenger RNA. If you try to, let's say you can't knock out the gene, but if you want to knock out the gene product, that is a good way of doing it.
Okay.
And so, yes, the sources of that RNA, you can either encode them in the cell as hairpins, you can feed in viral double-stranded RNAs, or you can synthesize short double-stranded RNA structures and then use these as inducing agents. All right, I will thank you all for the attention, and if you have any questions, I will be available to answer them either now or later. Which picture? This picture?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I took it. It is taken from, do you know where it is taken? Anybody has a guess?
From the
top? Gibraltar. Yes, from the top. It is not quite a Gibraltar, but rather similar. There is a little road, it is called West Camino Cielo Road.
Uh-huh.
And that is really rugged road. There is a bunch of people who drive those mountain bikes and shoot randomly. Mm-hmm. So it is homeless people live there, people go out and have affairs mm-hmm. there. Like, I drove by one day, there's like a van rocking up and down. So it's a wide place, but they have gorgeous views.
It's somewhere similar to that. It's incredible. I mean, when we finally get to the town, we actually hiked.
And you need a nice clear day. That's what I specifically waited until it rained in Santa Barbara. Because when you go up there on a normal day, it is just too hazy to take anything there. Thank you.
When are you teaching your drug class again?
I do not know. I had thought that I would teach it again this year, but there has been some shuffling of plans, so I might need something else instead.
Very cool. I think I should have called Highland,
okay.
Charm, and Galvin, so hopefully I'll have it done today.
Excellent.
So, you haven't ordered any data from here?
Oh, yes, thank you.
I haven't loaded any data.